you're all wrong about that, man. When you say you shouldn't get angry, you shouldn't curse, you shouldn't do things that upset other people, because that's what Jesus spent his whole life doing. He threw the money changers out of the temple. Don't you think that made some people angry? Don't you think it was rude to walk up to somebody's place of business, grab their table, and throw it out the door? You know, pious Christians sometimes make me very angry. They don't even know Christianity. They don't know the man they're following. He was a revolutionary. He was a dangerous man.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Could the reason the West is run by war criminals be pliable stooges have been fed into leadership factories and now running the show? How do the various leadership charities decide who, at the age of 16 or 18, is going to be a future leader? And if you're lucky enough to be selected, what are our future leaders taught on their Rhodes or Harvard Scholars bursaries? What, if anything, do they have to reveal about themselves? Also, rumours abound. Brexit or no Brexit, Britain's armed forces may be being integrated into the European Union's army anyway. We ask a former Royal Navy commander, is there any truth to the rumours? And if so, where does that leave us with Brexit? And a devastating new documentary series out on the History Channel, America's Drug Wars. Extracts from an episode one tonight, as we see the CIA flexing its post-World War II muscles, joining with the Mafia to take countries over. And what does the mob want in return? The CIA have got to help it monopolise the global supply of drugs. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, union leader Mark Sawatka is recovering from a heart transplant, and as his daughter Imogen discovers, he's still making the case for social justice through trade unions. And Sophie Sweetman presents a weekly show on Cornwall's community radio Source FM. She joins us to explain how firms like Nokia and BlackBerry have been squeezed out of the handset market, with Google now holding all the cards, killing off its competition. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. Or if you can't wait, download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, I'm joined on the line, I hope, down in the West Country near Plymouth by the editor of UK column, Brian Gerrish. Brian, hello and welcome to the Politics Show. Hello, Brian, can you hear me? Well, I don't think we can hear. He can hear me. Anyway, we'll try that again in a minute. Martin, can you give us an idea about what you think about leadership? Because there is a lot of this sort of stuff going on. I know when you were at Oxford, there were Rhodes Scholars, weren't there, for example?
Well, I mean, as you can imagine, there's always been elite groups recruiting people to their elite projects. And there are a variety of mechanisms that they have for doing that. The Rhodes Scholars, obviously, they were set up by Cecil Rhodes initially to, you know, give scholarships to people from the English-speaking Commonwealth, who would then be, you know, part of the imperialist project which Rhodes was so keen on. Although no doubt these days they will pretend, I mean, you know, Bill Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. They try and pretend that in actual fact it's not nearly as sinister as that, and that they're just giving opportunities to people from, you know, different parts of the world to come and study in Britain. But of course, you know, there's lots of other mechanisms for recruiting people. You've got your Skull and Bone Societies, the Bullingdon Club. You know, the Bilderberg group, as you know, as we've frequently talked about.
We're talking here about giving, you know, really kind of tapping people up at the age of 16, 18 and saying, well, we think you're going to be a future leader, and then kind of sticking them into a factory process almost to turn them into someone who's capable. I mean, you must have shared lecturers and things like that when you were doing PPE with some of these Rhodes Scholars, for example.
Well, that's right. And I think the fact is that, you know, you wouldn't be surprised to learn that, you know, at elite universities in Britain and the US and elsewhere, people are recruited towards elite groups, elite careers, and filled with the ideology necessary to make them, you know, suitable people to be involved in these networks.
Give us an idea of the sort of people you came across doing this kind of thing, Rhodes Scholars.
Rhodes Scholars, but I can't remember much about them.
Bill Clinton was one, wasn't
Bill
he?
Clinton
I'm not saying
one.
You met him. No, I remember meeting a publican in Oxford who said that Bill used to come in here to get his Coke.
Well, that may be so, but I never met Bill Clinton. But you've obviously got, at elite universities, you've got people who are, you know, part of elite networks. And some of them are already part of elite networks before they go to university through their families. Others are recruited to those elite networks by people, you know, once they get there. I'm afraid it's a sort of process that's very hard to stop and very difficult to control. But at the same time, you've got to recognise that that these overlapping networks of privilege do exist. There's no point trying to deny it. And we've got to be aware of it, understand the implications, and, you know, take a suitably critical response to it. One of the things that's happened in the past, for example, is that by giving scholarships to people to go to study postgraduate degrees in the United States, people get filled with neoconservative, neoliberal ideology. So both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown did further degrees in the United States, and they were, before they were elected as Prime Minister and Deputy Prime Minister or Chancellor of the Exchequer, they were over to the United States promising Wall Street and other people like that that they'd met during their time in the US that they were a safe pair of hands and that they were going to do pretty much what Wall Street and the Pentagon wanted, and so it transpired. And I'm afraid that is, unfortunately, the way the world works. There's not a lot to be done about it. Emmanuel Macron is another example of these kind of networks. You know, he's a relatively young guy, but he's ended up running France because he's one of them, as it were. That doesn't mean that everybody involved at that level is completely useless. It just means that we've got to be very, very vigilant about it and recognise what sort of thing goes on. Ultimately, of course, people from the outside of the charm circles can break in, especially when, you know, there are big movements in society outside the elite. But we've got a lot of work to do to ensure that that's the case, and we're nowhere near breaking the stranglehold of these elite circles on our political life.
Okay, Martin. Well, we're going to try and bring Brian on the phone now. Hi, Brian. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Oh, fantastic, at last. Right. Anyway, Brian, let's cut to the chase about, first of all, about this leadership charity, Common Purpose. I know you did a lot of work on it probably 8-10 years ago now when I first saw your research. What have you found out since about how it operates? And can you explain what it is to people who have not come across Common Purpose before?
Yes, okay. Well, in fact, it's I think the time I started to get interest in Common Purpose was going back to about 2002-2003, and it says that it's been going since about 1985, but I will say that in Plymouth I was just surprised to suddenly discover that that people around me — I was involved with the Chamber of Commerce at that time, but I was in the business community — I started to discover some of them were involved with a charity called Common Purpose. But they never said they were involved, and they never really revealed much about it. Plus, I had some strange things going on, so I started to dig. And where that led me is to an organisation that was recruiting people, and in its words, it was training them to lead outside authority. And I thought that was a very interesting expression. I became a lot more interested when I discovered that all sorts of people in Plymouth were involved with Common Purpose, and I had no idea this was the case. So it was operating in schools, it was in the police, it was in the local council, it was in the local education system, it was going into schools and supposedly training children. It was in the military, it was across the spectrum. And I was fascinated that we had this organisation, which I'd never heard of. I thought I was quite well informed on what was going on.
I mean, when you first came across it, though, didn't you think this sounds a little bit like the Freemasons? Because they've been doing that for centuries.
Well, to be honest, I didn't, because all I knew was that people, you know, were involved with this organisation. And I got a clue as to where to look when... I think there was an attempt to recruit me, and a lady gave me a little brochure, and on the brochure it had a list of names of people who were involved with the Common Purpose Advisory Board in Plymouth. And this was the senior Common Purpose people in the city who selected who else would be recruited and trained. So I just discovered it on that basis, and I had no idea how pervasive it was. That didn't come till later. So initially, no, I didn't compare it to the Freemasons, because I didn't really understand what it was or what it was doing.
So what have you found out more recently about how it operates? Because, I mean, you've become a sort of a go-to person. People around the country saying, oh, I've got a whole of a list of people in my city who are part of this leadership and training organisation. And yet you seem to, you get, I mean, is it something you have to pay for, or do you get tapped up and given
absolutely
a kind of bursary?
Well, they actually operate both, but in principle, you definitely have to pay for it. And at the time I started to investigate it, the higher level courses were about £9,500. A mid-level course was about £3,500 plus VAT. But to make it appear as though it was, you know, an okay charitable organisation, on a course they would allow certain other people to come in on very small sums, £200-300 maybe, or some of them free. And I did eventually discover that some of the firms, law firms, it happened to be in Plymouth, who'd used Common Purpose training, were a bit miffed when they discovered that other people had not paid anything for the same course. But I spent a lot of time over a number of years investigating Common Purpose. I asked simple questions. I wanted to know why local authorities or the police or the BBC or the military had used their training. And what I found in the first instance was that the moment you ask questions about Common Purpose, people became very elusive. A smokescreen went up. They didn't want to ask the questions. And at one particular stage, we discovered that if you asked a local council, for example, for information about how much they'd spent on Common Purpose, your freedom of information request was actually sent, a copy was sent to Common Purpose itself. And Common Purpose was collating a blacklist of members of the public who were daring to ask questions about them. Now, this and other documentation is on my site, cpexposed.com. So everything I'm going to talk about tonight, I will say where it is documentary, where we have the documentary evidence. But eventually somebody obtained a copy of that blacklist, ironically through the Information Commissioner's office, because Common Purpose was actually breaching, and so were the local authorities, they were breaching the Data Protection Act in releasing that information. So we had a charity that was creating, as it says, future leaders to lead outside authority. It was using principally people from the public sector and public money to pay for the courses, but when you asked for details, all of a sudden nobody wanted to talk to you. Where it's gone now is very quickly, if I do this, the Leveson inquiry became very significant, because we discovered that an organisation called the Media Standards Trust was working extremely hard to help set up a control system for the press and the media, and a gentleman called Sir David Bell was put alongside Lord Leveson. Sir David Bell just happened to be working for the Media Standard Trust and for Common Purpose. And so what it was pretty easy to show was that Common Purpose was whipping up the fraud we need controls for the press and media. And then in the judge and jury principle, Sir David Bell was sitting at Mr. Leveson's right hand, judging members of the press and media for their so-called failings. And
well, hang on, because they weren't so-called failings, Brian. I mean, they were hacking people's phones, for example, of one of them. I mean, there were lots of the Millie Dowler's parents and one of the victims of the 7/7 London bombings were having their phones hacked. So there was definitely something criminal going on there, and there needed to be an inquiry.
There was something going on, and I'll accept there were things that needed to be investigated. However, I've already told you that the proof exists that Common Purpose was itself breaching the Data Protection Act, and no public declaration was initially made that Sir David Bell held these dual positions. He'd been a campaigner for the need for an inquiry, and having campaigned using the Media Standards Trust, he was then brought in to sit alongside Lord Leveson. Moreover, when he was in that position, people who came forward in front of them who were Common Purpose, there was never any declaration of interest. And as a result of the research that we did into this, eventually the story of the Common Purpose involvement in Leveson came into the mainstream media itself. The Daily Mail printed 11 pages exposing the network and asking what this organisation was. The Telegraph also followed with the story, so did The Sun, so did The Guardian. So there was something deeply unethical, I can say, as a baseline. I will say it's sinister that we have a charity which is politically involved, had been involved in whipping up a campaign against the media, was itself breaching the Data Protection Act, and then we had a major figure sitting alongside Leveson.
And was there any suggestion that individual members of Common Purpose were using their positions once they got them in leadership to feather their own nests or the nests of others who were part of the group?
Well, I feel that the evidence we've got on CP Exposed absolutely shows this, because we've got documents showing that when, for example, Common Purpose got into a local authority, let's take Leeds, for example, it was then using its influence inside Leeds to get Leeds authority to spend more money on Common Purpose training. This is insider dealing. We were also able to expose that this was going on at Cabinet Office level, where a meeting took place with one of the Cabinet Office departments. Sir David Bell was in that meeting. In the meeting, it was suggested that Common Purpose should train the top 200 civil servants, but the minutes of the meeting as released to the general public were fudged so that they didn't actually mention the first time round that Common Purpose was effectively asked how much it would charge to run that training. And it was only when we chased the Cabinet Office and asked for the proper minutes that we learned that, yes, that was the case. There had been a meeting where Common Purpose had been present in the meeting, helping to decide we should provide training for the top 200 civil servants. And then we're going to have a little side meeting to decide how much we're going to charge for it.
Amazing. Well, it's very handy, isn't it, if you've got all these people beholden to you for training and you're able to help them get jobs in leadership roles.
In leadership roles. But if we get deeper into this, we find something perhaps even more interesting, and that is that if we go back to 2001, when we had the formation of the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister with John Prescott, Labour MP, Common Purpose was clearly was able to work through that office. So the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister was helping to promote Common Purpose training through public sector and civil service organisations. And if I spread the load, In more recent times, we've seen that David Cameron has been prepared to also promote common purpose. One clear example, which people can easily research, is that he was doing that whilst he was on a trip in India, where he was promoting common purpose training of a cross-section of Indian society.
Well, it just makes you wonder where their loyalties lie. But freelance journalist Sam Downey down here in Bristol has alleged that Marvin Rees, our mayor, has been through common purpose training, is one of these common purpose graduates. I mean, what are the implications if he has, Brian?
I'll answer that question, but before I do, can I just say, I wasn't able to just have a look, because I've looked at quite a few people, so I can't say whether he is or isn't. But this is one of the pernicious things about common purpose. If we have a charity which is offering people training, which is enhancing their ability, providing value for the public money that funds the course, surely everything should be open and above board. Surely people should be saying, with their hand held up, yes, I've done common purpose training. But what we find in reality is that the people do not do that. In fact, it took us a lot of effort to get into, have a look at the common purpose database, which was under passwords. We were able to see names because somebody who'd trained with common purpose was happy to invite us to have a look at the names. But we found thousands and thousands of people who were not declaring they were involved with common purpose. Now, when this is senior members of the police, take Cressida Dick, now Commissioner for the Met Police, she's common purpose. When does she meet other common purpose graduates, for example? Is that above board? So the first instance is this organisation is not openly declared. It's secretive. In that sense, we could say it's similar to the way we understand the Freemasons move. Now, to come to your question about the mayor, if he was to be a common purpose graduate, what would have happened is that he would have been put through a very carefully crafted training course where his views and values on political matters, on society, how society works, will have been gently changed. And how have they been changed? They've been changed by applied behavioural psychology. Now, if there's listeners this evening who are saying, well, that sounds a bit far-fetched, I think I also need to say, well, of course, you know that the government is boasting of its own behavioural insights team, where the British government...
Hang on, is this the Nudge Unit?
Yes, the Nudge Unit. And the government itself has been, and has said this publicly, it is so sure of its ability to use applied behavioural psychology to change people's behaviour that it sold the technology to the US and to Australia. It's even produced a document called Mindspace, which you can find easily if you just Google Mindspace. You'll come up with a PDF document.
Or your own favourite search engine, not necessarily Google. Yep,
well,
carry on.
Okay. Yes, fine. But if you go and have a look at that document, then in the document it calmly says people will have their behaviour changed and they will not realise this has happened, or if they do realise that their behaviour has changed, they won't know how it's happened.
Well, I'll put a link up to that on our show page, Brian. It's certainly something to look into, and it would be interesting. It'd be nice to ask Marvin directly if he's a member of Common Purpose, and he can say yes or no on this programme. I've just put another call into him this week. I'm doing it every week at the moment. Still haven't heard back as to whether he's going to come on and have a chat to us. But anyway, well, let's move on and talk a little bit about the threats to the armed forces, Brian, because I know that you're a former member of the armed forces yourself, aren't you?
Yes, I was a lieutenant commander in the Navy.
So, I mean, there are rumours circulating. The fake news, people will be pointing the finger and saying, well, that's probably fake news, about the possibility that the British Armed Forces are going to be integrated with an EU army, whether or not there's a Brexit.
Well, it is my opinion that this is absolutely happening at the moment. The government has been telling a pack of lies about Brexit because... David Cameron started the movement towards the unification of EU forces when he first came into power, because there had been a series of secret meetings in order to formulate the Strategic Defence Review. This is going back to 2010, if my memory serves me correctly. And these meetings had taken place in secret. So they'd taken place at the residence of the British ambassador in Paris, as one example, where senior members of the British military met senior members of the French military. They wore plain clothes, which I think is very significant. They didn't wear a uniform, they were in plain clothes. And these meetings were facilitated by another charity called the Franco-British Council. And at these meetings, what was clearly being discussed was full integration, because they were not only talking about combined British-French military operations with the forces themselves, they were also starting to talk about unification of the procurement chain for military procurement of military equipment.
So that's something that the people working at Abbey Wood here in Bristol, looking at doing all the MOD procurement, they would presumably want to know about that if that was going on.
Well, they should absolutely know about it, and they should certainly know, or be told or learn that all of this was done behind closed doors. It was not debated on the floor of Westminster. There was no debate. Do we think it's a good idea to go into partnership with the French? This was all done in a series of these very devious meetings, as with the one I've mentioned at the residence of the British ambassador.
But you see, the thing is, Brian, people will say, well, you know, there are bound to be contingencies for if Brexit doesn't happen, because although we've signed this Article 50 letter, it's by no means guaranteed that Brexit will happen in 2 years' time. And so it's quite sensible to have a kind of parallel track if we don't exit the EU.
Well, this isn't a parallel track, because there is no going back. What actually took place was, from the time that 2010 Strategic Defence Review was brought forward, we started to see constant and massive cuts of Britain's military forces. And we know why they did this. They did this because Britain was too powerful in a military sense to make an easy, balanced force across the European Union. So our forces were cut in order that there should be balance in the size of navies, in the size of various areas of operation across the EU, and also that the cuts would force European nation states to be interdependent on each other with regard to defence force levels and the procurement of equipment.
Yes, but hang on a minute, because we've got a common defence policy. I think it's called the Common Security and Defence Policy across the European Union. Sure, it makes sense, surely, to have some sort of integration of the actual forces that have got to implement that defence policy.
Well, it doesn't make sense to me if... let's put this another way round. What would the people of Britain say if they knew that 17 million odd people voted to leave the European Union? But up to this very day, what is taking place behind the scenes is the removal of sovereignty of the armed forces. And what I mean by that is the control of our armed forces by Parliament, by Britain as a sovereign nation. That control is still being passed into the hands of the European Union.
Amazing. Pretty scary as well.
In Parliament, Tony, if there had been a debate on the floor of the House and a decision had been made that this should happen, then that would have been the due process, and I and others would have to respect that. But there's been no such debate, and there's been no debate because the route to full EU military unification, which includes procurement, it includes the fact that they are going to set up an EU treasury in order to be able to control the vast movement of these defence funds. That is all happening as we speak. Theresa May and the Conservatives are utterly lying about what is really taking place with the military.
Well, I know it's part of the 2009 Lisbon Treaty. There was talk about the formation of an EU army. I just wonder whether, in fact, that there was also several articles, press articles, last year, just before the Brexit debate, saying that this was all being held back deliberately because they didn't want it included in the discussion in the run-up to the referendum. But, Brian, whereabouts would you recommend people go to have a look, or what keywords to search for to find out some of these things you've been talking about here?
I would suggest they go to the UK Column website, which is just UK Column, C-O-L-U-M-N, ukcolumn.org. And if you go to the search box, at the top line, you'll find the search box will come down. If you want to look at common purpose, put common purpose in, and you'll come up with a whole list of very detailed and very well-researched articles that we've done on common purpose. For common purpose, you can also go to cpexposed.com. Now, that website is a little bit old now. It's my website, but it has a searchable database where you can look for names of people to see whether they're common purpose trained. You can also call up real documents for all sorts of things, local authorities, police, health, education, showing what common purpose has been up to. You'll also find on that site the 11 pages from the Daily Mail and the other papers that I mentioned a bit earlier.
Okay. Also, Brian, your Common Purpose website and newspaper is one thing, but you also do a regular YouTube program, don't you? Can you tell us about that and maybe something that's been on today or the last couple of days?
Okay. Well, we every day via the UK Column website at 1 o'clock, we run a news program. Which is usually 45 minutes to an hour, and we talk about what we feel the real news is. Today we were talking about Grenfell Tower fire, where we've been pointing out that analysis we did over 2 weeks ago has now started to be followed through the national press. So we were talking about the cladding, we were talking about the fire risks, and we are still talking and asking questions about why the authorities are not telling the truth about the number of people who've died. But we've also been talking about European military integration. And all you need to do to see those broadcasts is to go to the front page of the UK Column website, and you'll see the video box is at the top.
Well, I mean, this Grenfell Tower, we were talking about it in the first hour with local councillor, Green Councillor for Cotton, Clio Lake here. Brian, the people who live in the Ladbroke Grove area are absolutely livid that there's still been no arrests. In your view, do you think that the police are actually up to the job?
I'm going to say I do believe the police are up to the job, because I still believe there are many good policemen and women. Do I believe that the senior officers in the force are being politically controlled to say and do the right thing? Yes, I do. Local people very, very upset, and quite rightly, because none of the standard procedures to investigate this type of event have happened, of which the simplest is that if you have a fire in a building of this size, the first question you have to ask is, what was the occupancy? How many people were in that building? And the experiences there from local residents and also people in the council, on any particular day, how many people do you expect to be in that building at a particular time of day? And once you've taken your best estimate of that figure, you have some idea of the number of victims you're looking for, because you know what the number of survivors is. But what the authorities never talk about is what the occupancy of that building was. And the reason they're not talking about it, I believe, is because it has been admitted in several places that the building not only had lawful tenants, there were also people who were illegal immigrants. There were other people in that building. We know that the fast for Ramadan had been broken, and there were a lot of Muslim families who invited in friends in order to eat. This was very important after midnight. The local borough council, the police, the government, nobody is saying how many people were likely to have been in that building. And the UK column was told very early on, when, for example, the BBC was crassly maintaining only 17 people had died, we had been told by one of the rescue crew that 50 bodies had been discovered behind one of the doors into the main egress point.
Well, let's just be fair to the BBC, because they were saying confirmed 17. They weren't saying that the total was 17. But anyway, Brian, I'd just like you to just remind us of your website, and thank you very much for joining us on the Politics Show. Can you just give us the website one more time?
ukcolumn.org and cpexposed.com.
It's Brian Gerrish from Plymouth. Thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show.
Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM. 93.2. Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM. 93.2.
Well, it worked eventually, didn't it? So, yes, Brian Gerrish there. And Martin, making some quite serious points, both about leadership that you started talking about. Thanks for helping us out there while we were trying to get Brian on the phone. It does seem completely wrong, doesn't it, that leaders, rather than just sort of emerging in a group in society, this is a bit about like group dynamics, isn't it? That basically you're getting kind of teenagers tapping them up and say, you're the leader for 20, 30 years' time.
Well, it's obviously not just teenagers. I think what you're going to find is that powerful interest groups are going to try and mould the people who are going to be the movers and shakers of the future. And that's always gone on and it's still going on.
Haven't they always done that?
Well, yeah. Exactly. They've always done it, and they're still doing it. So it's hardly surprising that you've got... What's interesting is the secrecy involved. If this is above board, as he suggests, then why can't we know all about it? That certainly raises questions, but it doesn't surprise me because, you know, this is the way that establishments always operate.
So let's move on now to look at this film, America's War on Drugs, and we're going to have a listen now to a little excerpt where they talk about something from 1954, right after the Second World War, something called the Doolittle Report.
This clandestine document, the Doolittle Report, is the key to understanding the last half century of the CIA's involvement in the drug trade. Issued in 1954, it lays out the core mission for the agency.
The Doolittle Report essentially said we might have to bend the rules a little bit, or we might even have to break the rules in order to combat this very real threat called communism.
The CIA undertakes extortion, kidnapping, torture, even murder, plotting assassinations and coups in Iran, Indonesia, the Congo, Guatemala, and now Cuba, where the Mafia are natural partners. It doesn't matter, the Mafia is also America's largest supplier of illegal narcotics.
The CIA enters into a devil's bargain. When you're at war, you will do anything in the short term that it takes to win that war.
Well, it's debatable whether the CIA decided to go into the drugs trade because they wanted to achieve political objectives, or whether in fact they were already working very closely with the drug cartels in the first place. But as we sit here in 2017, some decades later than 1954, and of course this four-part series has been shown on the History Channel in the US, it's pretty clear that the CIA have been heavily involved in the drugs industry from the very beginning, to the extent of being in control of it. And of course, once you've actually set yourself up to be in control of the drugs industry, Pablo Escobar's son, for example, recently said, well, my father told me that he was always working with the CIA. You begin to realise why the US pushes for no legalisation of drugs. They want to keep drugs illegal because the money they make from the illegal drugs market allows them to fund all of their political projects.
And what about the use of drugs for mind control and experimenting on people? Effectively, this is an extension of what the Nazis were up to.
Well, they've been doing that all along. I mean, there's evidence to show that they gave LSD to a whole village full of French people in the 1950s to see what the effect would be. But the real issue today is that the drugs industry is largely regulated and controlled by the CIA, so that the Drug Enforcement Administration, they go out and catch the little boys, the people that aren't working with the CIA, and that's then presented as we're trying to stop drugs. But of course, the big boys, the really big boys, the ones that really control it, are basically allowed to operate by the CIA. So they found a plane crashed in Mexico some years ago, and it was found by the police to be full of bales of cocaine. And that plane was last seen being used by the CIA to carry out extraordinary rendition at Glasgow Airport, because it had been spotted by people who, you know, do plane spotting. And it couldn't be a clear...
Well done, you plane spotters. You thought they were nerds, like train spotters, but they're not.
Well, the point is that there's a wealth of evidence. There's a website called CIADrugs.com. And there's a wealth of evidence out there to show that they've been involved in this for years. So there's a massive amount of hypocrisy about all of this. We've got a war on drugs in Colombia, which is basically a mechanism for allowing US military personnel to get a foothold in Colombia to fight against the social forces that they think are a threat to their control.
Well, we've had talked on this program
embedded with the drug cartels.
We've talked on this program several times about Basel in Switzerland with reference to the Bank for International Settlements, which is the central banker's central bank. It does seem like that place is the centre of the universe when it comes to Dark Lord Sauron's tower, because so much seems to have happened in the city of Basel. I mean, this is where people like Mark Carney were regulating or misregulating for many years before the 2008 crisis, for example. But this next clip from this programme from the History Channel, America's War on Drugs, actually starts in Basel.
While the CIA forms an alliance with international drug traffickers, it's also about to unleash a mind-altering substance that will change America forever. Two American spies have just arrived at Sandoz Laboratories, one of the world's leading pharmaceutical factories. The mission: corner the market on the world's supply of a powerful new psychoactive drug.
I would like you to sign for this.
Okay.
You could, please.
Sir.
The CIA has just authorized the purchase of 10 kilograms of pure LSD-25, enough to dose more than half the population of the United States.
The CIA saw itself as being in a kind of Cold War, psychological warfare, arms race with the Soviet Union.
I would like you to sign for this.
Sir.
What's the answer to controlling people and brainwashing them or getting them to confess? It's drugs.
The CIA has just authorized the purchase of 10 kilograms of pure LSD-25, enough to dose more than half the population of the United States. Sandoz even supplies the CIA with the receipt and shipping information.
The CIA was scared stiff the KGB was going to get all this LSD and come over and start dosing people. So we bought every drop of LSD in existence at that point. They gave it to George White and let George start dosing people.
George Hunter White, a larger-than-life undercover federal narcotics agent. He's known for busting international drug rings at home and abroad. But unbeknownst to his supervisors, White also works for the CIA. His job, to conduct experiments for an operation called Midnight Climax. White pays prostitutes to lure their clients to the agency's safe house.
George had a CIA safe house stocked with booze. George would sit behind this one-way mirror, drinking martinis, sitting on a portable toilet. If he had to take a leak, he didn't want to get up and leave. Hookers would bring these suckers back to the apartment. And dose them with pure LSD-25.
This is where I have my effect. In the mind.
This is lysergic acid diethylamide, better known as acid. The powerful drug was first synthesized in 1938 in Switzerland. With a dose of mere micrograms, the mind becomes confused. Perception is distorted. Personal identity is called into question. The results can be euphoric bliss or deadly panic.
Now, Martin, the dose he's talking about, the 10 kilograms of LSD, that's enough to dose 160 million people. What's the CIA need that for?
Well, they needed it, for, as I just explained, to try and control people's minds. And, of course, they were also thought of it as a military military uses. And I don't know if people have seen the famous footage of a British military squad being given LSD. And what happens, of course, is that their efficiency goes out of the window and they start wandering around looking at flowers and trees. That's the effect that the drug has.
So it was a military thing?
Well, it was a military. It was a test on you know, it was an unethical test on British military personnel to see what would happen if they were, you know, unknowingly dosed with LSD.
Anyway,
but that's the least of their problem. I mean, the real problem with the CIA is their involvement in the hard drugs import export business.
Anyway, so
with all the violence that goes with that,
it's an 8-hour epic. This History Channel documentary, and we'll be having some more excerpts from it over the next few weeks. But let's go on to now to have a look at some of the international news from this week. Martin, the Gulf states, we're told, want a restructured Al Jazeera, this standoff between the Gulf states and Qatar. It seems that they finally come out and said, actually, it's really all about Al Jazeera. We just want to control its editorial policy.
Well, that's right. But as I understand, I haven't been following as closely as I might, but I understand the Qataris are still standing firm and saying, well, you can't tell us what to do with our own TV station. Which is quite right. I mean, I don't always agree with Al Jazeera's editorial policies. In fact, they've had some very dubious reporting from places like Syria and Libya, but they've as much right to say what they need to say as anybody else. And attempting to try and close down people saying things just shows what the problem is, which is that people want to control information and control your mind.
Also, more horrific figures about civilian casualties in Iraq and Syria, although most of the mercenaries seem to be being moved over to Syria these days, and horrific figures for cholera in Yemen, which the British taxpayer is massively supporting and helping with satellite targeting. Our military are over there helping this carnage and the war crimes.
Well, they are, and also the Saudis are, as you know, are one of our major allies, and there is a report commissioned by the government on the pressings of the Liberal Democrats about funding for terrorism in Britain. And we find out this week that the Home Secretary Amber Rudd will not release the report because it's threatening to national security. And of course, what we suspect is in the report, which is what we knew already, is that the Saudis are major funders of extremist jihadism in Britain.
She's really saying there is that the government is threatening national security and they're too embarrassed to admit it.
Well, we've been in alliance with the extremists in Saudi Arabia for many, many years, and therefore nobody should be surprised to find that out. That's what we've been doing. Al-Qaeda was set up by the Saudis, MI6, CIA, with the Israelis helping. And that's how it came about. It wasn't an accident. They were recruited from all over the Middle East and sent to Afghanistan, many from Benghazi in Libya, where the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group has an intimate relationship with British Special Forces and intelligence.
Also, this week, Trump is not coming to Britain, but he has met Emmanuel Macron. And in fact, of course, Putin has been over there too recently. It looks like Paris and France, and Macron is the centre of Europe now, not Britain. And the Americans are kind of skirting around us. We're not really that important anymore.
Well, I mean, Macron's relationship with Angela Merkel is the key. And, of course, then the Americans want a relationship with the Franco-German axis. I think what may come out of this is what Macron said is that they're giving up the idea of trying to overthrow the regime in Syria. I'll believe that when I see it, because I think there are plenty of forces within the deep state, both in France and the US and here, who still haven't given up their delusionary goals of trying to change Middle Eastern countries through force.
And we'll finish up this week with a clip from Soraya Sepahfor-Ulrich speaking on South African radio this week about Egypt. It's often skirted around Egypt, but she talks about it in the context of water wars, because she believes that the whole idea of having wars, waging wars for oil, are being slowly replaced by waging wars for water. Of course, we're staying on the whole point of war not being anything to do with any kind of principle or moral idea, but just simply to grab resources. So this is the Iranian-born, living now in, educated actually in Farnham in Surrey, but living in California now, Soraya Sepahfor-Ulrich, and I'll put a link up to this on our show page too.
When Mohamed Morsi was still in office, he said that, you know, the Nile water is the blood of every Egyptian, and imagine what would happen if 80 million Egyptians went without water. And sadly enough, this was being recorded, this was being broadcast live, which caused a lot of embarrassment for Morsi. But every effort was being made to stop the progress of this dam by Morsi. And, well, there was the coup, and we have Mr. El-Sisi, who has handed over sovereignty of Egypt islands to the Saudis, which was the handing over of these islands. It's so very important, too, because in 1967, in fact, Nasser prevented Israeli ships from navigating through these islands, and now they're being handed over to Saudi Arabia with the blessings of Israel, who have been assured by the Saudis that they'll have freedom of navigation. But also the Nile water is being diverted. And El-Sisi is not the first to betray. He is, in fact, even in the New York Times archives, you have an article in which President Sadat of Egypt at the time, who was assassinated in 81, he had said that the Nile River could be a source of irrigation for Israel's Negev desert. And he said there's no reason that the sweet waters of the Nile shouldn't go to the Sinai and then onto, you know, Israel. It's just there's a little bit of literature, although not mainstream, about how there's always been plans to divert the Nile water to Egypt. And whatever is given, Nile water to Israel, excuse me, whatever is given to Israel and Saudi Arabia will deprive Egyptians and ultimately Ethiopia and Sudan, although it is made believe that Ethiopia, since they're building this dam, they will gain, not the people of Ethiopia, not the people of Africa. Yes, maybe a few cronies on top who are selling out the country and they're outsourcing its farmlands. 60-70% of the farmland in Ethiopia, in Africa, is being given to foreign investment, depriving the Africans of their food, much-needed food.
As Soraya said before, Ulrich there, Martin, she's talking about two things, I suppose, really. One is that you've got these puppet leaders now in countries like Egypt who aren't actually serving the interests of their own populations, and then also about this control of water being so important.
Well, it is. Of course it is. I mean, the control of water has been central to Egyptian civilization for thousands of years. So it's no surprise that it remains a crucial issue. And in Iran, the birthplace of your contributor there, control of water supply is absolutely crucial because it's a very hot country and you can't grow anything without water. So it's a very important... I mean, we all need water, don't we?
We certainly do, and of course it's a massive issue in Palestine, Israel too. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 5, though, 7 though. Coming up live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that's Green Councillor for Cotton, Cleo Lake, and Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, our sister show Dialects here at BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This show's story links and comments page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 2000. That is the Cuban Boys. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
at all. It's very cleansing for the soul to have no passion.